political dividing line between liberals or progressives and radicals is, do you oppose empire? Do you oppose imperial wars of your own government? Do you oppose your own government's continuing to attack and intervene in other countries? And do you oppose the restoration of white supremacy?
This consolidation of broadcasting and media into fewer and fewer hands has an impact on all media. And I think it has an impact on us as individuals and the way we understand what's going on in the world.
Notes from the Left Forum. The Conference on New Strategies for the Left looked back to look forward in an effort to identify and expand common ground among movements, ideas, and constituencies. The conference was held at John Jay College in New York City in June of 2018. In this program, award-winning journalist and co-host of Democracy Now!, Juan Gonzalez, in a plenary, One Fight, Many Fronts. Then Margaret Kimberly from Black Agenda Report on the fight for principled journalism at a time when many have been co-opted by corporate interests. First up is Juan Gonzalez, who offers optimism. He says he comes to give hope for social progress in the U.S. and the rest of the world. Gonzalez.
I think one of the things that is most important to grab hold of, I always had this argument with Amy Goodman, my co-host of Democracy Now! And others. I believe the most important thing that happened in the 20th century was that the people of Asia, Africa, and Latin America stood up. Colonialism, the old system of colonialism, was ended in the 20th century. Now, it happened because, and this is my own analysis, some historians might differ with me on this, the necessity of all of the various imperialist nations when they went into World War II to win the war required them to draft their colonial subjects into their armies and required them to go to the colonies and come up with more soldiers to fight. As a result, you see, if anyone who studies the civil rights movement in the United States, who studies the rise of the Mexican-American and Puerto Rican movement in the United States, that studies the rise of the anti-colonial movements around the world, realizes that it was many of the colonial soldiers who fought in World War II who came back to the colonies and demanded the same kinds of freedom and independence that Europe and the United States were espousing. So that the necessity to impress the colonial subjects into World War II laid the basis for the independence movements that arose afterwards, whether it was in India or in Algeria or throughout much of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And then something else started to happen. The Third World started coming to the West. And after World War II, you started having all of these mass flows of people from those colonies to the colonizer nations. What is the main thing propelling most of the fascist movements in the advanced capitalist world today? It's anti-immigrant fervor, anti-immigrant xenophobia. In France, they don't know what to do about all the Tunisians and the Moroccans and the Algerians. In England, they don't know what to do about all the Pakistanis, Indians, and Jamaicans. In Germany, they don't know what to do about all the Turks. In the United States, they don't know what to do about all the Latin Americans and Caribbeans and others from the Third World that have come to the West. When you look at the immigrant flows, the people have come precisely from the nations that once were their colonial masters. The reason there are so many Algerians, Tunisians, and Moroccans in France is because those were the colonies of France. The reason there's so many Pakistanis, Indians, and Jamaicans in England is because those were the colonies of England. And the reason there are so many Latin Americans in the United States, no matter what Trump or any of the others say, is because Latin America was the incubator of the American overseas empire. It was where all the great multinational companies were first born, in Latin America. So what we have seen increasingly is that the Third World has come to the West and has totally begun to transform the actual compositions of these nations. And as a result, there's an increasing backlash from the old members of those nations. Who was a Frenchman? Who was an Englishman? Who was an Englishman? Who was a German? Even who is a Swede today? And so there are all of these battles, and people are trying to grab onto the past when it cannot be grabbed onto. Unfortunately, what has happened increasingly as migrant flows have moved the third world into the West, there is now a whole new consciousness, I believe, in the working class of these countries. Who is the working class? But not the working class that you see on TV. Saying that they're all Trump supporters. Who is the real working class of America today? The people who are doing the hardest work, and you find that there's been enormous transformation of the working classes of these countries, and I think this is what is fueling the rise of this new fascist movement, this unease, this sense of fear that the nation that they once knew is changing and has to be stopped. It can't be stopped, of course, because you cannot have a capitalist world where you increasingly break down barriers for capital flows while you erect walls and barriers for labor. You cannot do that. If you are going to reduce the barriers for capital, you must also reduce the barriers for labor to be able to move freely around the world. So I think that's the big picture. Now, let me get quickly to what I think is what you're looking for more is in terms of strategy. I've spent 40 years now as a journalist basically covering urban America, covering life in urban America, politics in urban America, land policies, tax policies, political leadership. So I think I have gotten a fairly good grasp over the years of what is happening in urban America. And I believe that the key to progressive and radical change increasingly is in our cities. Now, you've got to keep your eye on the national and the state and do the best you can to affect change there. But the reality is that throughout the advanced capitalist world, national governments and regional governments are increasingly growing right wing. And however, the cities, which are much more diverse and inclusive and hold the majority of the populations of all of these countries, are increasingly going to the left because they are responding to grassroots movements that have developed in many of these cities. And that's part of what I try to talk about in Reclaiming Gotham, how this movement post Great Recession, post-Occupy, there's been a phenomenal growth of radical and progressive grassroots movement, electing people to office, then getting into key positions at office and actually practicing a different type of governance. Because you can criticize capitalist system and the problems of the capitalist system all day long. You have to have a vision of how you would govern differently, what you would do differently. And we have lots of examples of failures of progressive and socialist and left-wing thinking. So we've got to actually be able to provide examples of progressive and radical governance that actually improve the lives of people. So whether it's Anne Hidalgo in Paris or Ada Colau in Barcelona or Sadiq Khan in London or Gail McLaughlin in California, or Chukwu Lumumba in Jackson, or Raz Baraka in Newark, or Bill de Blasio here. And I'm not saying that they don't have their problems, every one of them. But the reality is you have movements that have developed, progressive movements that are beginning to seize power in these cities and provide a different perspective and vision of how you can govern. So I think that's the first thing. Local struggles that hold people accountable and gain power and show examples of progressive governance at the local level. Second is build the broadest possible unity among progressives. I remember back in 1968, and we were in SDS, and it was Nixon running against Humphrey. And of course, no one liked Humphrey. But we in SDS had the slogan, vote in the streets, vote with your feet. Do not vote in that election. do not vote. So many of the left boycotted the 1968 election. In retrospect, I think it was one of my biggest mistakes in terms of what Nixon represented from then on as the beginning of the right-wing onslaught that it went on for years. So I think that there were other examples over those years of the sectarianism of some of us on the left that refuse to recognize that we can have differences with folks, but treat them with respect and try to find the unities that we can have with anyone who is seeking to build a better life, and that we can find a way to look for the unities first and not for the differences. So I think that the first key issue of any key point of any strategy is one, build local grassroots movement and effectively govern. Two, build the broadest possible unity you can. And then the final critical dividing line between liberals or progressives and radicals is, do you oppose empire? Do you oppose imperial wars of your own government? Do you impose your own governments continuing to attack and intervene in other countries? And do you oppose the restoration of white supremacy? That those are, to me, the key issues. Build a strong local base, make the revolution locally first before you try to make it nationally. Two, build the broadest possible unity. And three, oppose imperial war, impose empire of your own government. Not that you could oppose other governments, but the key thing is oppose your own government's attempts to build empire. And to me, those are the three key points that I hope you will take away for whatever strategy you believe out of this conference is the one that you're going to pursue. Thank you.
Award-winning journalist Juan Gonzalez, and you're listening to Notes from the Left Forum on Pacifica Radio, WBAI, New York. Next up is Margaret Kimberly, editor and senior columnist with Black Agenda Report, also with UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. Speaking at a panel at the conference organized by Consortium News for Independent Journalism called The Death of Principled Nonpartisan Journalism, here's Margaret Kimberly.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. There's so much we can say about this subject of the state of the media. The death of principled nonpartisan journalism is pretty obvious to anyone who's paying even a little bit of attention, who actually cares about having such a thing. This process has been a long time coming, but we certainly can't overlook some very obvious things. First of all, nonpartisan journalism was killed off politically. I'm old enough to remember when we had the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine began in 1949, and it mandated that any holder of a broadcast license had to present, quote, controversial issues in an equitable, fair, and balanced manner, unquote. During the Reagan administration in 1987, the FCC repealed it. That was death blow number one. And then we have Bill Clinton, who was a godsend to right-wing neoliberal interests because he was a Democrat and he could get away with things Republicans couldn't. And one of those terrible things that he did was to sign something called the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And in short, the Telecommunications Act got rid of rules which prevented media consolidation. So up until that time, there was a cap on ownership. No one could own more than 40 radio stations. Well, now they're all owned by just a handful of corporations. 90% of media is in the hands of just six corporations. Comcast, Viacom, there's so few I can name them. Comcast, Viacom, News Corporation, Disney, CBS, and Time Warner. And some of them, like Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, own TV and newspapers in the same market, which also used to be prohibited. So I think it's important to point out that this situation where we find ourselves in was deliberately constructed, and it's not some accident of history. This consolidation of broadcasting and media into fewer and fewer hands has an impact on all media, and I think it has an impact on us as individuals and the way we understand what's going on in the world. Whether we realize it or not, that consolidation also starts to take place in our minds. And unfortunately, too many people grow accustomed to a consolidation of thought and a reduction in what we consider acceptable to talk about. There are boundaries that the media places on what we see and hear, and then we start to place them in our heads. And that means we will be more prone to listen to what is just pure propaganda. There are also economic factors that have killed off print media, especially the internet, which we all use and love, interrupted the model, the old model of advertising-based print publications, and they're suffering. So there is literally less journalism, layoffs, fewer jobs, fewer opportunities to make a living. And now even journalism schools don't produce journalists. They were always problematic, and they produce staff for elite publications and the State Department. And now they produce public relations professionals more than professional journalists. So now the only outlets we have are corporate interests themselves, and so there are certain things that they want. And it explains the sorry state of affairs that we see today. And it only exacerbates the media's inclination to do what the ruling elites, the governments, the security agencies, the presidents want them to do. But that problem always existed. They were always cozy with government. They always wanted access, and that's a double-edged sword. You can get access to someone in the State Department, but to keep that access, that means you don't print what they don't want you to print. There were always CIA assets in major newspapers. They always did this. But that process has accelerated since those Reagan and Clinton era decisions, which were demanded by the corporations that have access to politicians. And now every big name journalist you can think of is a mouthpiece for U.S. policy. That's how they get their job. That's how they keep their jobs. That's especially true with foreign policy, I think. The major media outlets don't want principled nonpartisan journalism. They fire people like Chris Hedges at the New York Times or MSNBC. They fired Phil Donahue, had the highest rated show on MSNBC, but they didn't like what he was saying about Iraq, so they got rid of him. Or Ed Schultz, they got rid of Ed Schultz. He was asking questions about the TPP trade agreement. But there's even more. Let's talk about the Washington Post, which I've mentioned. And like all the major newspapers, as I said, they always fought for access. And that means they compromised their journalistic integrity. But they had their moments, too. In 1971, the Washington Post published Daniel Ellsberg's whistleblower, documents the government didn't want to be seen. They also published documents stolen from the FBI. There was a group of activists, God bless them, who at this time, there were people during the Vietnam War who were raiding draft offices, stealing draft cards. And this group in Pennsylvania raided an FBI office and stole every piece of paper in the place, which they attempted to turn over to the New York Times, who turned them over to the FBI, to some liberal politicians like George McGovern, who turned them over to the FBI. But Ben Bradley at the Washington Post decided to publish them. And it's a good thing, too. We would never have heard the term COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. We know about that because of these documents and the effort, the successful effort to destroy the Black Panthers and other groups in the 60s and 70s. So, yeah, the Post was the home of CIA assets, but as I said, at that point in history, they would also do the right thing. Well, what's the Washington Post like now? The Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos, America's oligarch, thought to be the richest man in the world, worth $100 billion, the owner of Amazon. Amazon is now, and it's a disgraceful process, it's gotten too little attention, is going to build a new headquarters, HQ2 or something. And cities all over the country and in Canada are competing with each other to be the home of this Amazon headquarters. And what are they offering the man, the richest man in the country, if not the world? They are outdoing one another. We'll give you land. Oh, they'll give you 1 acre. We'll give you 2 acres. No, we'll give you 10 acres. Taxes, you don't have to pay taxes for 10 years. No, you never have to pay taxes. This man is getting away with theft on a huge scale. Do you think any of the Washington Post reports anything about Amazon? I mean, they do, but not the way they ought to. And the Washington Post played a role in something that's very insidious. At the end of 2016, there was a story, a group called Prop or Not, Propaganda or Not. And this appeared only in the Washington Post. And this murky organization, Prop or Not, printed a list of sites that they said were under undue Russian influence. Useful idiots, dupes. Black Agenda Report was one of those groups. Consortium News was one of those groups. It's a long, illustrious list of news organizations, and if you don't end up on the organization unless you are actually independent. But here's the thing to remember about Prop or Not, and it's interesting that this only, they tried to give this story to other outlets and nobody else would take it. That tells you that this is all a Jeff Bezos operation. It tells you it's a Democratic Party operation. And I don't think it was a coincidence that this happened shortly after the 2016 presidential election. Donald Trump, it's a complicated story, Trump. Trump said things that made him not trusted. His talk of a rapprochement with Russia, his opposition to trade deals. This made him a problem for many in the ruling, one wing of the ruling class. And after the election, I don't know if you recall, but Obama was always whining about fake news and people shouldn't believe everything they read. And this was an effort to shut down consensus, because here was this man about to be president and they didn't know what he was going to do. So the Washington Post gives us Prop or Not, and now their online masthead says democracy dies in darkness, which, Jesus. And I want to say, does it ever? But the Post is one helping that process along. So at any rate, we have less and less principled journalism because the corporate media and the permanent government don't want it. It's always at risk. And now they have put their thumb on the scales even more with this Russiagate hoax. Russiagate, it turns out, I don't want to digress too much, is almost wholly an invention of the Democratic Party to explain away their defeat, to accelerate imperialism, the goal of the United States to have hegemony and for Russia and any other country to stand back and let the U.S. do whatever it wants to do. We now know that this dossier from Christopher Steele, there are all these MI6 agents popping up. It would be good if the press weren't covering for the Democrats and we could find out more about it. This Christopher Steele was a former MI6 agent. He was paid by the law firm that represents the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. Now we know about this guy, Stephen Halper, who goes back to the 80s. Talk about collusion. When the Reagan campaign was colluding with Iran to make sure that Jimmy Carter couldn't free the hostages and would ensure a Reagan victory, he pops up again in this story. So what is the reaction from the Democratic Party? To make sure that whatever independence we had was killed off. So they attack Facebook. It's a Democratic senator, Mark Warner, who goes to Facebook 3 times demanding that they, now the story was about Russian bots. And let me just say about that, it's mostly clickbait ads. If they spend $100,000, I think it's funny that Putin wants to take over America, but is only willing to spend $100,000 to do it. So now Facebook has changed its entire platform. We've all noticed it. You cannot take out an ad, a political ad on Facebook, without giving Facebook your identification information. And they determine what a political ad is. It may not be vote for this one or that one. If you say the magic words Putin or Russia or Trump, whatever it is you want to promote can now be deemed political. And they decide whether it is printed or not. YouTube, which is part of Google. Google changes its algorithm, so Black Agenda Report, so Consortium News, World Socialist Web have all lost readers. Huge numbers. They don't give you the views they used to give you. If you go on YouTube, if you see a video from RT, there's a little disclaimer. RT is owned partly or wholly by the Russian government. But if you go on BBC, BBC gets public money. Well, I think that's under the control of a government, but at any rate, you don't. It's not stated exactly the same way. So just to sum up, it was always tough. It's getting a lot tougher to have real, objective journalism. I think as far as social media goes, we may have to go be old-fashioned and go back to email to be in touch with people. I think that is the next thing, that we go back in time as far as technology is concerned. But I think it's important to know that there was, while things were better in the past, there were always forces trying to do in good journalism, because it's all about controlling information and controlling what people do and don't know. So, but we're all going to be in the struggle, and I thank you for being here. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum. The conference in New York City in June sought to give light to new strategies for the left in an effort to create unity at the intersection of issues of identities, ideologies, and constituencies. In this program, you heard journalist Juan Gonzalez in a plenary One Fight, Many Fronts, and Margaret Kimberly in a panel on the death of principled nonpartisan journalism. This program was produced by Richard Barr and Linda Perry for Pacifica Radio at WBAI New York. Thanks to the Left Forum, and thank you for listening.